This is Thank You Heartbreak.
Hi, everyone. I'm Chelsea Lee Trescott.
As a breakup coach, relationship advice columnist, and the founder of Break Upward, Chelsea is passionate about human beings and their stories. She talks to people about their journeys in love, growth, heartbreak, revelations, and every wound and lesson along the way.
This podcast shines a light on heartbreak, showing you that the most crushing experiences are also your greatest opportunity to become meaningful, relatable human beings. Now, let's get to the heart of it. Hi, everyone. This is Chelsea Lee Trescott, breakup coach and podcast host of Thank You Heartbreak, and this is episode 206 with Monica Berg. I am so excited to say that we are finally catching up with the present day. We're getting close. I think we're about a month out. And what that means is that the episodes that I've been putting out have actually been recorded months ago. So it's kind of felt like living in the past. So we're creeping up to present day and I'm excited to start putting out new material. I do love this episode though. And one reason for that is that Monica herself also went through a bout with anorexia, and I think it's a rare circumstance that I actually speak with people that have gone through a similar experience as myself. And in retrospect especially, I see what a unique experience it was to really listen and speak with someone that knows the darkness that I too have experienced. And maybe you can relate to this when you meet someone that might have a similar family dynamic as you, or if you've ever had an addiction, talking to someone with that addiction, or any of the things. But for me, I think that speaking with someone that was anorexic at one point in her life, in fact, around the same age as I was, a beneficial experience. And I definitely learned a lot from her. You know, definitely some blind spots that I still have and ways, like harsh ways of looking at that experience. I think she really helped me reframe my own thinking. So thank you so much for being with us and choosing to spend your time here. So I would love for you to introduce yourself to my audience.
So I am Monica Berg. I'm a change junkie. I'm author of Fear is Not an Option and Rethink Love. And I mean, there's so much more I can say, but I'll start there.
Start there. We have an hour. What do you think was the hardest thing for you to change in your life?
My ability to be flexible and learn to lean into the unwelcome change that made itself present in my life.
I can't imagine how you were with quarantine.
Oh, now I'm a change junkie. So I'm amazing.
Yeah. You could handle it.
I actually found the gifts right and left. My husband and I started a podcast called Spiritually Hungry, which I had wanted to start for a few years. I started writing my third book and I finished a children's book with one of my daughters. We wrote that together and it gave me the gift of time actually and the ability to slow down and reassess. You know, we all need to do that. It doesn't matter where you're at in life. You know, what's working for me? What isn't? What do I want to do more of? What do I want to do less of? Mm-hmm. So I took that opportunity to change a lot of things.
I'm already nostalgic for it. So what do you feel like you've learned the most about your husband maybe during this podcast with him?
Nothing. We've been married 24 years.
Nothing.
because the thing is this, I think that the podcast, what's so cool about it is it's an expression of our relationship in a lot of ways. I mean, we're talking about many different topics and we go really deep, but we're also really silly. We've got a great banter. And I think our relationship works because we do know each other so well and we're constantly learning things about each other. Like we check in with each other all the time. We're very emotionally intelligent. We really put the effort in. So this is more of an expression of what already is.
Mm. Now, were you guys checking in with each other when you were dating? Is that foundation always there?
No, I think that's something you learn if you are aware of the importance of it. I think that the foundation, what always was there and what I think was our rock is that we always had the same goals in terms of the bigger picture, like spirituality, really growing from experiences. Our interest is very much to be transformative, to leave the world different than how you came into it. So that is where we're completely aligned. And that is for sure, no matter what has happened, the ups and downs that life brings, we always go back to that same place and we're very deeply rooted and connected in that way.
How old were you when you met?
Well, we met, and I've written about this in my relationship book. It was more of like a thud than a bang.
I have to hear this. I never ask these questions enough. What in the world? A thud, not a bang.
So the first time I met him, I couldn't even call it meeting. I was 17. He was 18. And I was born in Thibodaux, Louisiana. He went to an all-girl Catholic school. I'm Jewish, but I'd lived a very different kind of childhood. I moved to Beverly Hills when I was 8. I went to Beverly Hills High School. Like, you know, you can fill in the blanks, right? I mean, I had a lot of experiences that were not so spiritual, I'd say. Although in my soul as a child, like I always connected to something greater, like that always existed in me. But then, you know, I kind of lost that a bit somewhere along the lines. He was born in Jerusalem in Israel. And then he was raised in New York. He was raised in an Orthodox home, a spiritual one, but just different world. So when we came together, I mean, no, there's nothing on the 1% physical reality, like our five senses, right? That would have attracted me to him and him to me. His focus was just on studying and learning. And mine was more on being, right? I was spiritually awakened, but I didn't think it would come in the way of studying and learning in that way. And then I started to get very immersed in the wisdom of Kabbalah, which is what his family started, the Kabbalah Center, and he was raised in that.
They started it?
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Incredible.
So I became an avid student, and that's really how we met. But again, he had been studying Kabbalah his whole life. I was just new to it. And so for about 5 years, I think we noticed each other. I think there was something that we definitely noticed, right? Like I write about this too. It's a moment that you recognize as being different in some way. Like something feels strange even, but there's no context for it. There's no vessel for it. You don't even know where to put that, right? Only in hindsight later, you're like, oh, that did mean something. So we had those kinds of moments. Like he never even looked at girls. He was just, his head was in a book all the time. So the fact that he even spoke to me or would be curious about me was something, right? And I admired him for his discipline and for his wisdom, especially being just a year apart. By age, anyway. Then I developed an eating disorder at that time. I became anorexic, actually. So I went through my own struggle. And even though I really wanted to be loved and I wanted a relationship more than anything, what became the priority for me, the urgent and immediate thing I needed to address was to learn to love myself first and foremost. So that became everything. Even though I wanted to find somebody who would love me unconditionally, I knew that if I didn't really break all of the things, the false belief systems, the feeling of being undeserving, unlovable, if I didn't shatter that, then I could never really have an authentic relationship. So in the middle of that process for a couple of years, and I was becoming stronger and I was starting to find my voice and really know who I was and learn to love myself, flaws and all, right? That somebody was working on a project and he was spearheading it and they asked me to volunteer. And this is when I was finding my voice. So I said, no, I'm really overwhelmed. I'm going to college and I'm working full time and I'm already volunteering at the Kabbalah Center. Like, no, right? And for me to say no at that time was just like, I mean, now I have no problem. Now I'm like a completely different person. And so I said no 3 times. She was relentless. She just would not take no for an answer. So finally I said yes. So I went into his office to show him the work that I had done. And I just felt like ridiculous because it was out of my scope anyway. So I walked in and it was as if we saw each other for the first time and our hands touched by accident and like saw sparks. I mean, we were married 9 months later. So I think it's 2 things. I think it's timing, but I think also when you do the work that you need to do individually, we both were doing our own work, you're really able to draw the person that's meant for you into your life.
I really relate to the whole anorexic, especially at 18. But what was so different in your experience and mine was your father was really a rock for you. And you talk about in the book how he had this unconditional love and he didn't come in with judgment. He didn't ask the questions like your mom did. My mom was the opposite. She was more like your dad. And my dad was asking all the questions kind of in this mocking tone. What do you think it was about your dad that was able to take that approach with you?
You know, it's so interesting because if you met my father, I mean, he has Alzheimer's now, so he's still here, but I sometimes talk about him in the past tense and he's somewhere in the middle of in this world and not, but he's Middle Eastern, very stern, authoritative. It's not the way I describe him in the book. And by the way, when he feared things, And he wasn't sure of the outcome, right? He couldn't control it. Mm-hmm. It was a different version of him. And that's what my mother did, that a parent would want to control the situation. They're worried about the outcome. And we're talking about starvation, right? Yeah. Self-inflicted and self-imposed. But my father, he just loved me through it. I think that he didn't worry about the outcome in this case. It's almost like he saw me as being wounded and vulnerable and injured. And innately, he knew I just needed a support, not verbally, just somebody walking by my side every step. And that's really what he did. I mean, those were, I think, the most beautiful, I'm not going to get emotional. I think those are the most beautiful years that we ever had together as father and daughter.
So sweet. Yeah. It was the opposite for me, but it took a long time to, you know, overcome, just to get the relationship back. I remember for so many years having such a hard time looking my dad in the eyes, you know, and it's like the unspoken, that's not good either. I think for a long time, it was just not spoken about.
Did he ever answer you about why he couldn't handle it differently?
I think it was just, he just didn't know who I had become. How did I let this happen? Like, I'd gone to college and I was so fearless. And then to come back and just to see someone that he was afraid of, number one. And two, it's like I came back from college and I started dating this best friend of mine. And so on the outside, there was such joyfulness in my life for the first time. You know, it's like I was so joyful. And I think it was really confusing for people. How could I be so in love and so happy and yet so starved and, like, you know, just so quickly losing that weight? You know, it was almost like it was overnight. It's like you try to do it the healthy way for so many years of your life and your weight really never fluctuates. And then the moment I made this decision overnight, it's like I became 83 pounds. It just happened so quickly. And I talk about this, I don't know if you could agree, but I'll never forget being in New York. I say it really saved my life. I moved here when I was 83 pounds and people just, they were so honest. They were so critical. People said the worst things on the street, but I think it saved me. I always felt, though, like I wasn't being bullied. It's like I was just feared. I think that people are scared when they realize, like, you're one decision away out of being outside of your own control. Like, I didn't stop eating and say, this is going to happen. It just did. I fell outside my own grasp.
I think that people fear things they don't understand.
Yeah.
And people don't understand anorexia because, by the way, it doesn't make any sense. It's not a logical thing that happens, right? And that's why I like talking about it. I'm actually really excited to talk to you about this because I haven't met many people who have recovered like myself. And a lot of people still are plagued by it, right, for the rest of their lives. I'm curious, what happened with your boyfriend?
Well, he was similar to like your dad, which is exactly what I needed in my life at that time, was someone that didn't acknowledge it, though in retrospect, it could be considered like enabling. But he really, in ways, was like introducing food and restaurants to me that got me excited. So I wasn't as afraid of it. But eventually, there's one time he was visiting me in New York and he broke down in tears and he said, "You're killing yourself." And it never had occurred to me that that is what could happen or would happen. And I didn't wake up at that moment, but it was one of those things you kind of collect these lines over the time and it comes together and it wakes you up. But I went and did a study abroad in Paris and I broke up with him when I got there. I didn't think I would do something like that. But in my mind, I think that in order to get better, I had to, unfortunately, leave behind the people that allowed me to be as bad as I was. There's something, I think, to be said about when someone sees you at your worst and accepts you, that there's an ability, if you're weak enough, to stay that way because they accept you. They love you. So What is the real impetus at my age and at that time to get better? So I broke up with him, but we're best friends now. You know, and I remember when I reconnected with him recently, a few years ago, and I apologized to him. And it was something that he didn't understand why I was apologizing. But when he started dating me, you know, he didn't ask to date me at that point. Like, he had fallen in love with this girl when we were best friends, and he was trying to date me that was really strong and, by what people thought, confident. And he saw me through a very terrifying time. I mean, to see, also to have sex with someone that's that thin and the questions that he was asked, I just can't imagine, like, the private terror that he experienced, though he says he never really saw it.
It's interesting, right? Perception. Everyone's is different. And by the way, I mean, you keep saying that you were strong and that you were confident. I think that you know, by the way, it takes a lot of commitment and strength to be able to even go through with this, by the way.
So true.
My husband and I joke about that part. I think that your soul has a calling for something greater. And I think that when you deny it and you're punishing and not kind to yourself, I think it can go in this way. Mm. And that's also a need for control. So I don't think it has to do with weakness. I think it has to do with being misguided. And again, that severity, the harshness, the lack of compassion and kindness for oneself. And I think people who suffer from eating disorders just go extreme with this. I always say I'm really happy it happened, in the sense that a lot of people live in that space. They can tolerate it because it's not so overwhelming like it is for somebody who's gone through an eating disorder. For me, it was, you know, this is life or death. Either you choose to love yourself and you start to be kind to yourself and that narrative in your mind changes, or you will die. So it became urgent and immediate. And I'm so grateful for that, because I could be like so many others that I see and that I speak to and that I help, that they're still so punishing and so unkind, but it's tolerable. Again, it's not something that, you know, they can live with it, because it's not really like killing. It's not killing them, not immediately anyway. I mean, I think it's slowly chipping away at their joy, which is a slow death. But
Do you remember like the final straw that kind of forced you into the eating disorder?
I do. I remember the exact moment.
Me too. What was yours?
Isn't that funny? So I told you we lived in New Orleans. I had a very, very happy childhood there. I mean, I have vivid memories of smells and sounds and things I played with and even thoughts I had from ages 3, 4, 5, which I think is pretty unusual. Again, we're Middle Eastern Jewish. We lived in a very white Christian neighborhood, but my father was very wealthy. So somehow we were accepted, right? Even though we were different in so many ways, he was a self-made millionaire. He built this beautiful mansion. And then my mom wanted to move to California. So my father wanted to make her happy. They decided to move. He lost all his money in that process. His business partner backstabbed him, you know, a whole thing. So when we moved to California, many, many things changed. My mother went to work for the first time in a family business. Now being Persian meant something else in Beverly Hills. A lot of Middle Easterners were emigrating there at the time. There was this big stigma. Suddenly I was labeled and looked at in a different way that was pretty negative. My father was unemployed for many years. I saw him on the couch depressed. I mean, just night and day, right?
Wow.
But again, it taught me to be hungry spiritually.
Yeah.
and to really, you know, okay, so if money doesn't create long-term happiness and money is fleeting and people are pursuing this, none of this makes sense. I got to figure this out, because I don't want to have that life, right? So I started paying attention in a real way. So then years later, there are indications, you know, they found out it's genetic now. I've done some research and there is a gene. Of course, there's triggers like anything that's genetic, environment, how things are in your home, outside pressure, right? There's a whole array of things. It's personality type as well. But the trigger for me in that time, besides what I just mentioned, right, especially Beverly Hills, everybody's exceptionally pretty. And, you know, it's this perfection thing that just, that's all I needed. I'm wired like that anyway, you know? Mm-hmm. Again, I've changed that part, but that's how I used to very much be. So we went to New Orleans for the first time since we left. And I was 17 at that time. And it was a scary time also. All my best friends were going away to school. My father, being as strict as he was, wouldn't let us leave the house till we were married. Limited where I could go.
You leave the house till you were married?
Not to go away to college. No. So it limited a lot. So you start to not even be hopeful for those things, because there were so many limitations. It was very old fashioned in a lot of ways. So that restriction, you know, it just was a lot. So I already had these feelings of like my life was ending in a way, the life that I knew anyway. And I was terrified of the unknown, of what was going to be now. And we went to New Orleans around that time. I went to our old house that my father built. We saw all of their friends. And my sister, my older sister, was very angry, I think, in those years. I'm the middle child. We're three sisters. So I was like the fixer, you know, fix my parents' marriage, fix my sister's problems, like fix everything. And there was that pressure on top of my own pressure and fears of what that meant for my friend circle and my own future. And then to go back and see the devastation and the look of loss on my parents' faces and regret, it was just, that was it. It was the final straw. And we had dinner with this group, like our friends that we had from our childhood, their friends, and it was a table of like 12 people. And I just had a breaking point. I'm like, I can't do this anymore. Like, I just can't do this anymore. And I remember I was pushing my food around. And this thought came into my head that said, I don't ever have to eat again. Yeah. Yeah. That's what I'll do. I'm never going to eat again. And just like that, I mean, that was the beginning of it. Mm. It was so weird though, because it wasn't like, it was like something that almost came over my shoulder into my brain. It wasn't something that was conscious, even though it sounds like it was. It was just a coping mechanism of everything in my life is spiraling. I feel completely out of control. So yeah, I'm going to control this one thing because that's what I can do.
You feel like there's part of it, like because you were the fixer, like you said, and it was about fixing your parents' marriage and all that. And also just the restriction that was already there within your family that you were like, you know what, I'm going to have a problem of my own.
You know, I never thought of it that way. I do speak about designated issues. It's like you focus on one issue that's pretty bad, so you don't have to focus on the real issues that are far worse, which I think that this would tie into.
Really? Maybe what was the far worse issue?
Would be, you know, my parents are suffering and life is about suffering and pain and everybody's destined for that. Now, I don't believe in suffering, right? That's not my belief system, but I couldn't fix that big problem at 18. And nor should I have ever been in the position to have that on me. You know, my mom was like, you're my best friend. I need you. No, I'm your daughter. I'd like to have a mom now. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And my father, you know, you understand me. He felt very judged by other people for not working in this time. Like, because I'm empathetic and I am understanding, everybody was like, well, you understand me. And these were mammoth problems. And I'm just starting to figure out, I should be leaving the house now, right? So I really do think it was about the lack of control, but perhaps this was such a big distraction. I think that, yes, in a way it was like, I can't take care of you anymore because I can't take care of me.
Right. Like, I'm stepping away now. Like, I'm busy on my own project now.
Yeah. Like if you put a sign on your store saying closed for the winter. You
know? Right.
Exactly. Right. That type of thing.
Now, did it bring them together at all, or did it push them away into this blame game of who's responsible for this?
You know, it's funny. My parents' relationship was, you know, it's very interesting because I'm trying to be respectful of their relationship and of their feelings, but I'm only sharing this to help anybody else. My father, I know my mom was always the love of his life. Like, he was very clear about that. And I really think that she loved him too, although I think she couldn't access it at the time. They don't have, and they didn't have any of the skills or the tools that I write about in my book. You know, they didn't learn how to fight. They didn't learn a fighting style. There was no spirituality between them. There wasn't a lot of commonality. There's a lot of blame in their relationship, a lot of yelling and lack of appreciation, right? So those are things that kill any love affair. It doesn't matter if you're in love or not. If you don't have those things, even if you love somebody, you won't be able to access that love. Mm. Now, I didn't know this then, what I know now. So it was just confusing. If you fight so much and you blame each other for everything, then why are you together? Now, relationships aren't that simple, right? They're very complex. Now that my father has Alzheimer's, my mom's really spiraled in a different way. And she remembers the good. I mean, she remembered the bad for a while too. But I just think that when you assign somebody to be the reason for your problems, it doesn't allow for any growth or change. So they didn't blame each other actually with my eating disorder. That was one area where it actually brought them together, oddly enough.
Amazing, though, right?
Like, yeah.
I mean, again, like, look at you fixing things.
Right, I know. I know. Wow.
Yeah, I can't imagine that it was her idea to move and then things collapsed.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, what's crazy too is you guys go to Beverly Hills where wealth is everything and it's all about perception and image. And it's like, you guys just had that in New Orleans. And it's like, if you could have transferred that to Beverly Hills, how great, how fabulous.
You know what? I think if that had happened, I don't think I would really like who I am today. Yeah. You know, I think that everything is completely divine. And they do realize that actually, that, you know, the silver lining for them. They say, oh, you know, we're so happy we moved because you met your husband and you found spirituality. And
wow.
And they both studied Kabbalah. So they're able to see that. But honestly, I have to say it was the biggest life lesson for me to watch them. I mean, as hard as it is, sometimes our parents teach us what not to be, right?
Wow. And what about your sisters? I see the silver linings as well. Or was it more difficult?
I think, you know, with every child, it gets easier. So I think my older sister had a really hard time. I think she more mirrored my parents in more ways than I did.
And she was accustomed to it longer, like that lifestyle.
Yes.
More part of her identity.
Yeah, it was important. It was important. I think she was more in it than taking a step back and watching it like I did.
Mm. And then what was the impetus to finally overcome the eating disorder? Do you remember the last thought where it's like, today is the last day of starving myself?
No, it wasn't like that. So when I fell in love with my husband, still was very much in the throes of this eating disorder. But, you know, being with him, it was the first time that I really ever felt loved unconditionally. Because again, he fell in love with me where I was at. But it was also the first time that I felt seen and I felt heard. And we laughed. We were just so silly together. It was the first time I was genuinely happy. And not that he made me happy. It was that, well, he certainly did, but we brought out something in one another that allowed us to be in a way we were never with anybody else. And then from that, it's almost like I just moved past it, which again, doesn't happen normally in that way.
Mm-hmm. It's like you outgrew it. You outgrew that version of yourself. Now, do you think that this is a great way to date is, you know, kind of explore each person and then the person that brings out something in you that hasn't been brought out before, maybe pause there and see if you can commit to that person. I'm trying to think about ways to kind of gauge whether, is there something internal within us that we can trust upon, an instinct or something that we can trust and say, if it's not here, this person is probably not the person we're going to marry.
I mean, I don't like to answer in yes or no, because there's so many variables. I think what happens when people seek out a partner, they go by their five senses, right? In Kabbalah, we call it the 1% realm versus the 99% realm. So 1% is everything that you see, you hear, you smell, you touch. It appeals to your physicality. And that can be very misleading, misguiding. I might be attracted to somebody, or maybe they have money and that makes me feel good and I can buy things that I couldn't before, or maybe they just make me feel pretty. Whatever it is, those things can leave. Like I just gave the example of my parents, right? Money, looks, even attraction, like all of that can fade. Sex lives change. If it's just based on that, something that is monetary, that's not a stable way to go about it. But in the 99% realm, that consists of compassion, kindness, empathy, unconditional love, transformative sharing. It's all of these things that in and of themselves have life to it. Mm-hmm. If you're compassionate, there's a life, there's an energy that is living in that, right? And it's contagious. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's first and foremost. And laughter, levity, all of that is under that umbrella of 99% realm. So when my husband and I finally were able to see each other, we weren't looking with the five senses. We were looking in the 99% realm. I think our souls recognized each other finally. And from that, again, I did feel seen. I felt heard. I felt loved, and vice versa for him. I mean, he never felt safe enough to be able to really show anybody who he was. So I think that's the indication. I see so many times where people are like, oh, I can't really tell the person I'm dating that, you know, they'll leave or they'll judge me. Well, you know what? You want to hide aspects of yourself for the entire relationship? Do you really want to start like this? Because if you start with lies and covering up things, by the way, is still lying, even if you're not.
No, lies by omission, the worst.
Yeah, you're going to forget, by the way. You're not going to be able to keep track of all the stories. And you're never really going to be able to be who you are. You'll never really be authentic.
You'll never trust in the love that you're even receiving, because you think that, like, eventually when you're exposed.
Because it's based on something that's not real.
I loved your definition of authenticity.
It's about being genuine, honest, and entitled to acceptance.
Mm.
Being authentic is really acknowledging that we're imperfect, yet we're still worthy of belonging. And I think that that's the key there. Because I think often people are like, oh, I'm going to hide this until I like myself better, or till I think I'm perfect, or I've perfected that thing. And then I can show who I am, because then I'm perfect. There's no such thing. We're all in the middle of a process. That's forever, right? When a person's at the end of the process, they're dead. I think we misunderstand that, right?
I feel like maybe in a small way or a big way, that's kind of what your podcast has been. I remember that, like, wanting to reach a more perfect state to start something. And you use the quarantine as, let's just do it now. You've been thinking about it for years. And it's not like you were in the perfect place to be doing it. You just made it the perfect moment to start.
Well, I had to convince I was ready. I didn't care what my thing is. Cause again, I used to be the perfection thing. Really. I just don't do that. I hate that word. I'm not interested in, I love being flawed. when I teach, I give life examples and I like show my stuff because first of all, I never want to be put on a pedestal because you will knock me over and then you're going to discard me because you don't know where to put me anymore. Mm. And two, I think people can learn from each other. I'm just like you. You're just like me. And even if I spend more time learning something, maybe I can offer information, but we're forever learning. I don't ever want to be somebody that forgets that. So with the podcast, he just finally like, cause it was always like, we don't have time. That was his thing. And so we actually only got one microphone because we're like, let's try this. I'm not sure it's going to be any good. And we sat in our living room and we literally are like eye to eye. Our knees are touching. We're facing each other. We have to be that close because there's just one mic. And the first three that we recorded, it was so intimate even for us because we're sitting talking about like, I mean, our concepts are like one's on forgiveness, one's on happiness, one's on parenting, one is on evil speech. So we're looking at each other, right? Like this close. And I had to look away a few times. I'm like, wait, this is so intimate, right? And I think that's what makes it powerful too, because it's just us raw.
Mm. So you've had children, four of them.
Yes.
Mm. What prepares you? Can you be prepared for motherhood?
Well, it depends how you consider motherhood, right? And how you define being a good mother.
And, sure. And you don't like yes or no questions.
Yeah, you're never going to get a yes or no from me. And also I think how you feel about your own upbringing, your own, like, I think to really embrace motherhood in all its forms, because I'd like to unpack everything. I think that you really have to be comfortable with yourself to some extent and also comfortable from where you came from. Right. And even though we're all, again, in the middle of a process, I can tell you, I have been a different mother to each of my children because I'm changed by all of them and by each experience. I remember early on after my first, I think I finally had more empathy for my mom and for some of her choices. You know, it's the only time you can ever fully put yourself in your parents' shoes.
Wow.
Because if not, you just really don't have the context. It's like, oh, wow, you were terrified. I understand that. Like, I understood now how terrified my mother must have been. It's unexplainable, you know, when I was going through anorexia. You can't even describe that feeling. And I only started to realized that when I had my third child, my daughter, and one day when she was like seven, she was like, oh, she started talking about bodies and weight and, you know, and I was like, oh my God, she's seven. And it terrified me. I'm like, I cannot, after knowing what I went through and that sheer terror, how isolating and alone I felt, you would never want that for somebody you love. So, and my approach to being a mother, you know, I could never be a stay-at-home mom. I really applaud women that can. But my approach is that they're not mine, that I'm here just to help them navigate whatever they're meant to be. And even if I have an idea or a desire or a wish of what I'd like them to do, I would never put that on them because they wouldn't be happy. And in the end, they would be searching like the rest of us later in life. So I really feel like my job is to hear them and then help them identify what it is that speaks to them and show them the ways by powerful suggestion, but not this, I told you, I was raised like that, right? You should have done this. You could have done that. Like that regret, that constant worry of like, oh my God, if I make a mistake, that's it. There's no going back. I never wanted to do that to my kids. So, and also I very much put them in a position where they can teach me as well. You know, every soul is different. My kids are very different than I am. And I see beautiful ways that they do things. I'm like, oh, I want to be more like that. You know?
Wow, no way.
Absolutely.
I love that. That's so special. Absolutely. That's so special. And you talk about that within relationships, you know, how you have to let someone be on their own journey. And that too often, you're talking about like the Michelangelo effect and like how we can try to shape someone to their ideal way, but it'll never work unless they want the same ideal for themselves.
Absolutely. So the Michelangelo effect, and there's also something called the golem phenomenon. So it's basically like you have a statue, right? And you're molding it and you're shaping it. This in relationships works if your ideal of what you want them to be is aligned with their own ideal of what they want to be themselves. Mm-hmm. So if a man, for instance, wants his wife to be like Marilyn Monroe, but she really wants to be like Joan of Arc, clearly there's going to be a problem and a disconnect and it's not fair to her, right? But if his vision of her is the same as what she really aspires to be and he helps mold that, that's a very strong, successful relationship.
Mm.
And the golem phenomenon is the exact opposite. It's when you want them to be made into something that you think they should be.
Mm. How did you handle having children four times and then having had an eating disorder when you were younger, I mean, did it trigger it? Sometimes I think about this, I have no idea, but could this trigger that feeling in me like, oh my God, beyond my own control, my body is changing?
Well, it's really interesting. So I got married when I was 23, a month shy of my 24th birthday. And then I had my first child a year later, 25. And so I remember it was the healthiest I had ever felt with food in a long, long time. Because again, I had changed and I was no longer that person. I felt like I had tools, I had a voice, I learned to love myself. I was still learning to love myself. Again, all those things keep growing over time, but I was no longer that person. So I didn't feel like that could ever happen to me again.
Mm-hmm.
It just could never happen. It could never happen. I can say that completely with total certainty. And I remember when I was pregnant, the first time I was like, you know, it was so much bigger than me. You know, this life is growing inside of your body and everything's changing in a really beautiful new way. And I remember I just really craved steak. And I was a vegetarian before that, by the way.
No way.
I still go back and forth because I'm really not a meat eater. It's just not something my body wants, but my son certainly did want it. So every week I had to have a steak. And I loved coffee Häagen-Dazs ice cream. I never would have eaten that if you force-fed me when I had the Häagen-Dazs. Are you kidding me? But it felt so good to be able to respect what my body wanted. And I didn't have a fear. I went right back to my regular size each time. And to be honest, I don't enjoy being bigger. I'm not comfortable with that because it's just not what I'm comfortable with. I'm very active. But I loved feeling the baby inside of me. I loved that connection, that spiritual connection. So never an issue.
That's another thing that I feel like, you know, I have this certainty that I would never starve myself again, that I could never get to that spot. And it's been, I mean, this happened in 2005. It's been a long time. But I can't say that if I was 30 pounds heavier, not pregnant, just 30 pounds heavier, 20 pounds, I don't know. Like, I don't know how I would feel about myself. Have you ever thought of that? Like,
I do think that the lingering effect of anorexia is body dysmorphia. I think there's a residue that never quite goes away. Like I can tell you honestly, if I look in the mirror, I can't really see myself for what I look like. If I look at a photograph, I can.
Mm-hmm.
It's a weird disconnect that happens. So yeah, I wouldn't be comfortable heavier, I think. But I hope that I wouldn't beat myself up about it, right? If that were to happen. And again, I don't know. I mean, that's never happened outside of pregnancy.
I just have like, leading up to the eating disorder, I felt like it was 7 years of my life thinking about my weight every other minute. And, you know, no one was aware of that. That after it was done, I really made this commitment that I didn't want to spend any more time on it. Like I didn't want to be someone, because I think that there is people and there's this encouragement to love the thing you hate, to speak to your body, tell your body you love it. It's like, I can't. Like it just... I don't know. I didn't take that approach. I've chosen more indifference than trying to love and accept. And, you know, I'm not going to be walking around my apartment naked. I don't know if that's the wrong approach. But maybe this is just my approach. Because I think that there's two things that you can do when you're overcoming an eating disorder. I mean, I've heard a lot of people say that you should learn to love the thing that you've hated.
Yeah, I think that's aligned with you should learn to fully embrace yourself and love all parts of you, even the parts that you don't love, because that's truly freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And I do. I would say I think it is important to get to that place. And I think for me, the way that I've approached that is in strength. I work out a lot. I really like the fact that I can rely on my body to show up for me. And I appreciate it and I respect it. So I treat it with respect. I think that's the evolution of my relationship with my physical body.
Mm.
And I think it's important. I do.
I definitely snoozed on that. I used to be very athletic and it's something that I have not approached again. What type of workouts do you do?
But even if it's not athleticism, I think that just that conversation, that appreciation to be able to see how beautiful your body is because it shows up for you each and every day so that there's a connect again instead of a disconnect. And it doesn't have to only be through food. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be through anything, right? So let's say that you do yoga, or let's say even you play the piano, or any expression through your body to try to find a space where you can really show gratitude and appreciation for it. I think it's really, really necessary in the healing process of this.
Yeah, maybe I've just missed, I haven't connected that because I know that I'm so present in the world. You know, I'm always in front of people. I mean, that takes my body. You know, that takes me putting myself out into the world and showing up.
But then how do you think about your body, right? I think it's a part of the healing to be able to, because for me, I like to look at every aspect of my life, right? And make sure that it's, I'm doing the best or the most that I can, whether it's in my relationship or as a mother, as a friend, a sister, a mentor, a writer, an athlete, right? So if there's a part that I'm avoiding in any one of those areas, in any of those boxes, I will go and unpack it.
Mm.
I don't want to leave any stone unturned.
Have you ever been an avoider?
No. Well, let me think about that for a second. I think that before and during anorexia, I did not like confrontation. And I would stay in that space, right? I would recognize something and I wouldn't do anything about it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do enough about it, or I would do the wrong thing about it,
yeah.
Right? So that wasn't satisfactory to me. And I would still think about it, right? It wasn't like I didn't notice it. So what I started to do is say, okay, how can I make this work for me? This thing that isn't working for me, this thing that's uncomfortable and unacceptable, what can I do to make it something that's positive and powerful?
Mm.
And I write about this in my relationship book about having a default emotion. Everybody has one. And you'll find it in the theme of your life. Like for me, it's sadness. So I realized that any time in life that I was going through something difficult, when my father lost his money, had anorexia, when my uncle became schizophrenic when I was 7, it happened like overnight. In my eyes, it happened overnight because nobody talked about anything. And then when my second son was born with Down syndrome, I just realized that sadness was the thing that was like the soft cushion for me. And sadness sucks, right? So I realized that I'm not really a sad person. Sadness is what shows up when I need to pay attention to something.
Mm.
But what is sadness really? Sadness happens when I feel like things are out of my control, that I have no say in anything, no effect, right? Everything is, I'm at the whims of the universe, which is total nonsense. So what I started to do is when sadness would come and say, okay, I'm not sad because I can do something with what's in front of me. I'm going to transport that and I'm something that is powerful. So I do this exercise in my relationship workshops where you put your default emotion on your name tag, you know, so you would write Monica, sadness, and then you cross that out and then you realize what the real emotion is, and it's Monica's powerful. So that became the way I approach everything. Anything feels mediocre, not acceptable, not acceptable. Because we're all destined for greatness and it's up to us to be able to find that.
Mm. How did you find that you could be powerful in the situation with your son?
Well, that I think was the real, I mean, with all the things that happened to me in life that I've just shared, that for me, that changed my whole world in the best way possible. And think about it, I already went through tremendous change, right? I was already on a spiritual path. I'd already found my spiritual home. You know, I married my soulmate. And so with my second son, and I didn't find out till he was 3 hours old, that I was met with feelings of shame and undeserving again. A lot of those feelings that I had with anorexia came right back up again. And then I had tremendous anxiety for about 2 months. And I went through an array of emotions. And I allowed myself to go through that because I really wanted to come to a place where I could choose my son again. So first I had to mourn the idea of the child I thought I would have, the child I thought I was growing inside my body, come to terms that my body did not betray me, even though that's what I felt like, right? Again, with that whole body issue.
Of course.
So imagine those kind of feelings. And then I thought, well, this didn't just happen to me. It happened to my husband also. And I don't think that he's deserving of bad things. And by the way, some of my belief systems are still very flawed and I don't want to be that person, right? I thought that I had worked through a lot of things and I remember caring what people thought. Are they going to judge me because I have a child with special needs? What's it about me? And so I thought, wait a second, I caught that thought. That's not who I want to be. And I realized he was the greatest gift. He is the greatest gift. He taught me what real love is. He taught me to really let go of care. I could care less what anybody thinks. Let go of judgment, of expectations, of all of those negative things we're also attached to, of approval right out the door. And then I really started to embrace change. That's the only constant. Why do we expect that everything's going to go exactly as we want it to? And then we get so devastated when it didn't turn out that way. Who said that things are going to be exactly as you want them to be? And then we're just shocked. So I realized that it's the uncertainty in life is the only thing you can count on. And that's a beautiful thing. That means you're not going to be affected by anything good or bad that happens to you. And you, by the way, that is freedom. That is joy. That is happiness. That is purpose. So I really did. I embraced that and it was a game changer. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. By the way, so I was so anxious. Shortly after that, I went from being pregnant to being a size too, like very quickly. And of course, the rumor started, oh, she's anorexic again. Look at her. And I was like, no, I am nervous.
Yeah.
Scary for me. I don't know if I can mother him. I don't know how this is going to be. How is it going to affect my whole life? And in the moment, I decided, you know, most people, they have a child that's born and the child seems healthy and typical. And then later in life, you discover the areas where they're lacking, right? Sure. For me, it happened the other way around. I saw the things that were lacking on the day he was born, but I had a lifetime to discover his gifts. So I really just changed the way that I thought about everything. And that's why all my books are called Rethink. They're all the Rethink series. My blog is rethinklife.today, because really the way we think about things is pretty backwards.
And how have your children been with their brother? Like seeing that, because you will obviously, like you're pointing out that people, you see judgment. You can see judgment on people's face or the questions. And then kids can be the most curious of them all. But within your own household and your own children, how are they with their brother?
They are great because they didn't know he was different. We never used the word in our house. And we never talked about it until they noticed he was different. So my oldest is 21 now. He's Aquarius. So he's not
21?
Like that.
Oh my God. What? Wow.
My youngest is 7. So I have a big stretch. But he is not very detail oriented. So I think that when he finally realized Josh, I mean, there are certain things he'd notice along the way in the years. And I would say, you know, well, Josh is better at basketball than you are, and you're better at reading or writing. The whole idea is that we're all different and we all are stronger in some ways and weaker in other ways. And that's what makes everybody beautiful. That's our house, right? They all understood that. And then when David finally was like, well, Josh seems a little bit more different, we told him what there was a diagnosis. And so he Googled it actually. And then he was devastated because the things they write, you know, are horrible. And that's why I don't believe in diagnosis, because then it's everything that comes along with that. Like even when I had anorexia, I didn't want to call it that. I just said, there's a lack in my life right now. Mm-hmm. Because if not, you have to have every symptom that comes along with any disorder or any disease. And Josh, I refuse to put him in a box. I refuse to limit him in that way. And the doctors tried to tell us that also. And when we wouldn't listen, they said, oh, you're just young. You know, why aren't you listening to us? And I was like, you know what? Because you're not God. And we don't know who Josh is going to be. And don't limit him. And so I didn't listen to anything they said. I raised him just like I raised all of my other children. And wow. He's doing exceptionally well.
Wow. Yeah, I love that. Some of the stories that I've seen on Instagram where these families get really big, it's usually from the whole like being given a diagnosis and not paying attention to it, or like you're saying, not even looking into it. Because then you feel like you're kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop, or you're looking for signs to be there that maybe you wouldn't be looking for. It's almost like you're pushing someone in that direction.
They said that he would never be able to eat solid foods. And I deleted that email from one of the therapists. And so I gave him solid foods. The next day, he was fine. I refused to do that to him. It would be so cruel. And again, I don't believe in a life of limitation. I don't believe in a life of suffering. I don't believe that people are different because you've decided they're different. I think we're all different. And you need to help each person find their strength and their unique offering to this world. And everybody can offer something. Everybody.
God, there's so much to you. There's so much to you in your life. I coined the word break upward, and I'm curious what it might mean to you. Break upward.
Upward. Well, it's everything. It's rethink, right? Mm-hmm. It's to not take what you see so seriously and as truth, because it's going to be layered with our limited beliefs and some of the negative things we have. So I think it's to constantly question and explore, you know, how else can I see the situation? Mm. What else can I learn from this? How can I derive purpose and meaning from every single experience, even the ones that aren't welcome?
You brought up freedom many times, but what is your definition of freedom?
It's to not be affected, as I said earlier, by anything, which is a really difficult place to get to. And it's something I've been practicing for a long time. And sometimes I succeed and sometimes I don't. But it's this idea that you're almost untouchable. So, you know, somebody really liked what you did. Great. That's so nice. But not to get overly excited about that. Somebody really hated that you did that. Well, that doesn't feel so great, but not to get so excited by that, because none of it's real. I think freedom is that you keep trying to reveal who you are and to help elevate yourself and the world. And if that is your focus, I mean, first of all, nothing feels better than that. And then also, you're never going to be derailed.
I love this all. Tell my audience where they can find you.
You can find me on Instagram at MonicaBerg74. My blog is rethinklife.today. And we're going to start doing it live on Facebook. But for now, you can listen to our podcast, Spiritually Hungry, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Are you able to tell us what the next book in the series is?
It's called Change Junkie.
Change Junkie, nice.
And it's a series of essays, because I really like to give examples from my personal life, clearly, but also very like profound, but simple and short. Like, I want to turn your brain upside down, and then I want you to like go with it and just seek change.
Thank you for everything. Thank you for being so open about every journey, honestly, and being able to speak to you about the whole anorexia. You know, I saw that when I was reading your book, but I didn't have a chance to even ask if we could talk about that. But thank you for being so open about it.
Yeah, I didn't know we had that in common. And also, I want to thank you because, you know, I do a lot of podcasts and sometimes people aren't always prepared or they've just skimmed the book, but you've clearly done your homework. And it's nice to have a conversation that can really explore different things and talk about them in a real way.
Got emotional about it. Yeah, and you remind me that there's just so many different things that can happen to us in our life that we don't see happen. You know, your father, your son. But also just that, like, there's something to be said that you and your husband found each other with the spiritual work. Sometimes it makes you think, like, you guys are the perfect people to be dealing with these things and seeing them as gifts and teaching the world that they can see it the same way. And so it's almost like it was meant for you. It really was made for you.
What's interesting, we often say that the Creator brought us together to do this work. Like, I think that all those things happened, not only for this reason, but I think a big part of it is like when two people come together and they have a responsibility for the world that they've taken upon themselves. So you're going to have challenges, but it's because you can rise above them and help other people do the same.
If this episode resonated with you, it would mean the absolute world if you could pass it on and let other people know about it. How you can support this podcast is really just sharing it, telling people about it. If you know someone that's hurting in their heart, tell them about Thank You Heartbreak. And if you want to be a guest on Thank You Heartbreak, reach out to me. You can find me on Instagram at Thank You Heartbreak, or you can email me directly at Chelsea, C-H-E-L-S-E-A, at BreakUpward, BreakUpward. And if you're interested in one-on-one coaching sessions, you can visit my website, breakupward.com/shop, where you can check out directly from my site. It's a super, 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 super simple process. Of course, I will answer any of your questions before you book. And again, you can email me at chelsea@breakupward.com. There's many different coaching options. And I would love to show up for you as you begin to show up in more wise and clarifying and secure ways for yourself. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be right back.